From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. On today's edition of Fresh Air, I speak with Molly Yard, the newly elected president of the National Organization for Women. Also, I talk with novelist Tom Clancy, the author of the best-selling military thrillers Red Storm Rising and The Hunt for Red October. His new novel, Patriot Games, is about international terrorism. Rock critic Ken Tucker reviews the latest album from Kid Creole and the Coconuts, and film critic Stephen Schiff looks at Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs. The Disney classic is back in theaters this summer, 50 years after its premiere. That's all coming up on today's Fresh Air. My guest is Molly Yard, the newly elected president of the National Organization for Women. She says she was born a feminist because of what she was exposed to growing up in China, where her father worked as a Methodist missionary. Seeing women kept in a subordinate role in traditional Chinese society left her with an outrage that never subsided. Yard is now in her mid-70s and has been politically active all of her adult life. Before devoting her energies to the women's movement, she worked on the campaigns of Pennsylvania Senator Joe Clark and Philadelphia Mayor Richardson Dilworth. She served as NOW's political director before succeeding Eleanor Smeal as president. I spoke to Molly Yard earlier today from the NPR studios in Washington. I suggested to her that her age has captured the imagination of many Americans who are inspired by her continued activism. I asked her how she's reacting to all the fuss about her age.
Well, I'm amused. The first question I was asked by, I can't tell you how many reporters, but mostly men at the beginning, first question out of their mouths was, how old are you? And I simply said, I'm old enough to know what I'm doing. And it is a question that is made much more of in terms of women. So I wanted to make a statement that I did not think age was relevant. The only thing that was relevant to the delegates at the NOW conference was whether or not I had the background, the ability, the experience, and the guts to do the job. And they apparently felt I did, and nobody ever talked about my age. If they did, I never heard it. I'm clearly not trying to pretend I'm young. I couldn't. You just have to look at me, and you know I'm not a young person anymore. And furthermore, if you know the kinds of things I've done, you know I have to have been around for quite a while. So I'm not at all trying to appear young. I'm only trying to say that there are not many times that age is very relevant. What's relevant is what you feel able to do.
I think that your serving as the president of NOW might actually break some stereotypes. For instance, the stereotype that feminists are younger women who are single and don't have children. And there are a lot of people who believe that stereotype.
Well, that is a stereotype. But let me tell you, when I talk to NOW chapter presidents across the country, I think the overwhelming majority of them are women who are married and who have families. We have a lot of both, but there is no predominance of any one kind of person.
Gloria Steinem once said that women get more radical as they get older, in part because they have to face independence as they get older, and so many women end up as widows and are really on their own. Do you think that that's true, that women get more radical as they get older?
Well, I think it's true for some women. It's not true for me.
You've been radical all your life.
Right, in terms of wanting to change what is. But I think there are some women. I don't understand why. I've never been able to understand it. But I think there are some women who just grow up and get married and have a family and don't think about the way women are treated until all of a sudden they're left by themselves for whatever reason, separation, divorce, death. And we used to have a wonderful person in Illinois in the ERA campaign who would start every speech with, all marriages end. And they do. It's either death, separation, or divorce. And women who haven't thought about being totally on their own suddenly wake up to the fact that the world looks down on them and they have a very tough time.
Before we talk about the political agenda for now, I'd like to talk a little bit about your life. Now, you describe yourself as having been born a feminist because you grew up in China. What was your first realization that women had a secondary status in China?
I really can't tell you that. It was always there. And but not only was it always there, I discovered it was in the USA when we came here. I was 13 and a freshman in high school, and I discovered very quickly that the same attitude towards women that I had known all my life in China was here, too.
Were you surprised?
Yes. I'm sure I idealized this country and thought everything was going to be perfect. I discovered almost immediately that it is not, and I loved sports, and I discovered that in high school, the girls got to use the gym when the boys were finished with it. Period. End of the question.
I think it's fair to say that not many women of your generation went to college. And for many women who did, it was a prelude to marriage. Did you have your heart set on going to college?
Well, I'm not sure what the figures are. My impression was that everybody I knew went to college.
Really?
Absolutely. But I also came from a family where my mother had wanted to go to college, and her father, who was perfectly able financially to have sent her to college, simply said to her, college is not for girls. And she was bitterly disappointed, and she was determined that every one of her daughters was going to go to college, and we did.
You became politically active in college. You were the recording secretary of the American Student Committee. What kind of issues were on the political agenda of that student group?
I'm sorry, that is incorrect.
Oh, okay.
The American Student Union, of which I was national organization secretary and eventually chaired it, was organized after I got out of college, but I was very active on the campus, chiefly at Swarthmore, on the whole question of women's fraternities. They would not admit Jewish members, and the members of my fraternity were really enraged by it because a good friend of ours in our class was Jewish, and we wanted to pledge her, and we weren't allowed to, and we decided it was a no-good system, and so we organized to get rid of it, and we did.
What were some of the other issues you were politically active in then?
Well, in college, I was very interested in what was going on politically in the country. I was interested in the fact that the trade union movement was at the stage of where it was kind of going to burst forth again. I remember we ran a forum at the college in which we brought in all kinds of outside speakers.
Did you have career plans?
Oh, well, I always wanted to be a member of Congress, if you want to know the truth.
Did you ever run?
Well, I had very carefully picked out my district, and I was well established in it. And then my husband decided he wanted to go and teach law and ended up in Stanford. So I got removed from the district, which I had carefully picked and worked in. And we had a family, and as he said to me many years later, I never thought about what you wanted to do, only about what I wanted to do. So it was just another example of women's dreams not being even thought about. And we did eventually move to Pittsburgh, and I did run for the state legislature in Pittsburgh in 1964.
It's interesting to me that when you got married, you kept your own name. More and more women seem to be doing that now, but very few women did that when you got married.
That's right. That's very true.
Why did you want to keep your own name, your last name?
I never understood any reason to give it up. I was Molly Yard. I am Molly Yard. And I did not see any reason to change that. It's absolutely, it seems to me, total put-down of women, that you suddenly become Mrs. Sylvester Garrett. I mean, that's a man's name. That's my husband's name, not my name. It's a denial of my individuality. And years later, very interesting, I was on the board of the Pittsburgh YWCA, And everybody was on that board as Mrs. John French or Mrs. Edward Spiegel or whatever it was. And but I was always going by my own name of Molly Yard. So we had a whole discussion, it was in the early 1970s, about how people would like to be listed on the Y letterhead. And we went all around the board, and almost every person on the board wanted to be listed in her own name. Now, at that point, she had her husband's name, but she didn't want to be listed as Mrs. John French. She wanted to be listed as Helen French. So I thought that was very interesting, and the board changed. The Y changed the listing on the letterhead.
Was your husband understanding when you decided to keep your own name?
Well, I said to him when we got married, I said, I hope you understand I'm going to keep my own name. I think he was surprised, but he didn't say anything and accepted it.
How did you get around your children's last name? Did you hyphenate?
No, I didn't really care about that. If they were born a Yard or a Garrett, what difference did it make? I'm not interested in immortality and having my name go on forever. So it's just simpler for them to go under Garrett because the other way would totally have confused everyone. I didn't see why they should deal with confusion of society just because I'd chosen to keep my own name. So they're all Garretts. Now, my daughter has hyphenated her name with her husband. They both have. And so her daughter is known as Garrett Goodyear, as is the rest of the family.
My guest is Molly Yard, who was just elected the president of NOW, the National Organization for Women. Did you take time off from your political goals and from the work you were doing to raise your children?
Well, I took some time off, but basically it was because, some of the time it was because my husband was changing his job. But I guess the time I really took off of my own volition was when I was pregnant with my third child, and I decided the time had come I was going to go into politics full time. So I had my third child, and I was heavily into politics.
Working on other people's campaigns.
Right.
You've described Eleanor Roosevelt as almost a second mother to you. How did you meet her?
Well, we, in the student union in which I was active for several years, we were very, very critical of the New Deal. And we had a fine student magazine called The Student Advocate. The editor was Jimmy Wexler, who was years later the editorial page editor of the New York Post when it belonged to Dorothy Schiff. Anyway, it was very critical of the New Deal, and Mrs. Roosevelt, as was her wont, was very aware of what was going on all over in the country. She kept her eyes and ears open, and she realized that we represented a group of young people in the country and that we were not at all happy with what was going on. So she just called up one day and said she'd like to come and talk to us, and she did. And she made it her business always to be very aware of people's needs and to do anything that might be done to meet those needs. Most of us became very close to her, and that relationship existed all the years that she lived.
Did you ever commiserate with her about being a politically active woman?
Why would I have commiserated with her? I envied her position, and I learned a lot about her political life and how she had blazed trails for women, and also about how to deal with defeat. Because if you are in political life, you're not going to always be victorious in everything you're doing. And she was a wonderful teacher of practical politics.
What were the times when that advice about how to take defeat really came in handy for you?
Well, I think it's true a lot of the time. People say to me all the time, now, why are you such an optimist? And I say it's simply because, and they say that, because we have seen one defeat after another in the women's movement. We didn't win the Equal Rights Amendment. Affirmative action is being attacked everywhere. Family planning is now being attacked by the Reagan administration. we are seeing one disaster after another, and it gets to be discouraging. And people say to me, how do you remain optimistic? And I say, simply because I've lived a long time and I've seen a lot of progress for all kinds of groups and in many areas. And I believe that if one keeps working at what one believes in, if it's a just cause, it will eventually prevail. And a lot of that I learned from Mrs. Roosevelt. I remember one time she just said, well, you're never going to win all the time, and you have to learn to live with defeat and to just pull yourself together and go on, because you will see eventually that you will gain what you're working for.
My guest is Molly Yard. She's the newly elected president of NOW, the National Organization for Women. We're going to take a short break and then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live from WHYY in Philadelphia and is distributed by National Public Radio.
Molly Yard is my guest. She's the new president of the National Organization for Women, and she's joining us from the NPR studios in Washington, D.C. You had worked on many other political campaigns, campaigns of men running for mayor and for senator. When did you decide to focus a lot of your energy on equal rights for women? When did you join the feminist movement?
Well, as I've said, I have been a feminist all my life, and in everything I did, I was very conscious of the fact that women were left out, and I always made it my business to make certain that when I was running conferences, we had women lecturers and so on. So I'd always been active myself in whatever small ways I could be. And so I was absolutely delighted when the National Organization for Women came into being. I didn't join immediately because I was heavily involved in political campaigns, and I don't like to be a member of an activist organization if I'm not going to be active myself. And I'm happy to support them, but I really don't join. And when the time came that I thought that I could do that, and when it was going to be very helpful to things I was working on, I contacted NOW, and I became a member of it in 1974, and I've been a member and very active ever since.
In the late 60s and early 70s, I know that there were a lot of mature women who felt uncomfortable with the feminist movement because it seemed to be so dominated by younger women, and also involved in a way in a more radical subculture. And I wonder if you stayed away from the women's movement during those years, or if you felt uncomfortable
Heavens
with it
no.
at all.
Uh-huh. Heavens no. Never even paid that the slightest mind.
Mm-hmm.
I just was heavily involved in running political campaigns, and I don't know whether you've ever been in a political campaign, but if you're managing one, you have absolutely no time. You are there at 7 o'clock in the morning, and you're probably there until midnight or later, almost every day of the week while the campaign is in full swing. And you don't really have time to do anything else, and I was engaged in some very important campaigns, in my opinion.
You're the former political director of the National Organization for Women, and now you're the president. Now, I think there's always been a bit of a controversy within NOW about whether its primary role should be activism within the political process or whether it should be exerting pressure from outside the political process. In other words, whether the primary activism should be in terms of demonstrations and rallies, consciousness raising, or whether NOW should be supporting candidates and working within the political process. I guess I think I can guess where you stand on that issue.
Well, I don't divide them. I think you have to remain very, very visible, and you have to get your message across. And one of the ways you do that is to have actions of all kinds that are visible, like marches and rallies and pickets. You also do a lot of educational work by producing pamphlets and kits on all varieties of subjects in which the organization is interested. But we learned very clearly in the drive to ratify the Equal Rights Amendment that we have to change the legislatures. The math of it is just very, very clear. In state legislatures, we got every single black vote there was. We got 75 to 80% of all the women votes. We got around 49, 50% of the white males. Since the white males make up 85% of the legislature on the average, the math of it's very clear. You have got to have more women in the legislatures or it's going to be impossible to win this battle. So we decided in 1982, after the Equal Rights Amendment went down to defeat, to get into the political process very heavily. And we had our political action committee, and we established more of them in our states and some of our big city chapters, so that we could raise money and make contributions to candidates at every level of office, local, state, and national. And we raised a lot of money, and we did help a lot of candidates. But the process is very, very slow. We are just eking ahead, and we're not going to be anywhere for way into the next century. And so it seems to us much too slow, and we've got to work to speed up the process. In that regard, I am very happy that a group of women who agree that we need many, many more women elected to public office are setting up the Fund for a Feminist Majority, which Eleanor Smeal is going to be running. I think that is going to help find many more women to run. We will work on it also in the NOW organization. We learned how to do it. We stayed in several states after the Equal Rights Amendment went down. I personally stayed in Florida. Three of us from the National ERA Strike Force stayed in Florida. We worked with the NOW organization in Florida and other women's organizations, and we got a lot of women to run. And as a result, we doubled the number of women in the Florida Senate, the Florida House, and we had enough votes in Florida. If we'd had six more months, we would have ratified the ERA.
Under your leadership, do you plan to take NOW into new directions? Are there new political items on your agenda?
Well, I think it's hard to characterize them as new. The issues remain the same. The only thing that's going to be different, I think, is that we're going to try and do a much speeded up kind of flood the ticket with feminist candidates all over. We're going to do everything we can to urge women to run for school board, to run for city council, to run for county commissions, mayors, statewide office, legislatures, Congress, etc. And I hope that I hope very much that Patricia Schroeder will run for the presidency. I think her running will very much speed up the whole process and will be a tremendous boost to the idea of women running for office.
What kinds of actions do you have planned for the near future in reproductive rights?
Well, in several ways, we will be keeping the reproductive question in the forefront. The nomination of Bork to the Supreme Court by President Reagan raises the question very, very quickly and starkly. He has said, Robert Bork has said, that the decision of the Supreme Court to legalize birth control and to legalize abortion and allow women to have a choice of choosing a safe and legal abortion, he says those are totally unconstitutional. And if you read his writings, and I have read some of them, and he is a prolific writer and speaker, what he believes is very easy to find out. He would, I believe, be the one who would reverse Roe versus Wade. The last few decisions on Roe versus Wade have been 5-4 decisions in our favor, and Justice Powell was the swing vote, and he is now gone. He will be replaced by a man who will vote to reverse. And I can tell you that American women are not going to tolerate that. We will do everything we can to see that he does not get confirmed.
Do you see consciousness raising, that old word, as being an important part of your job? Will you be reaching out to women who have not considered themselves feminist or joined the feminist movement in any way?
Well, the place I would really like to work is among older women. We have a lot of women who are older and very supportive, but we know that one of the areas in which the Equal Rights Amendment doesn't do as well is among older people. And frankly, I think we have not done a good job of getting older women to understand how the Equal Rights Amendment would improve their economic situation.
Why has it been more difficult with older women?
Well, I think probably the chief reason is that among older women, there is a greater percentage who have led the life of a homemaker, have worked as a homemaker, and they aren't as aware and haven't thought about the discriminations against them, unless, for instance, they are suddenly divorced by their husbands, and we keep running into this kind of case where a woman at 55 or 60 is divorced. The only Social Security she is entitled to is as a dependent of her husband. If he chooses not to retire at 65 or whenever, there is no Social Security coming to him or to her. So she is entirely dependent, and it may be the only means she has of getting any income at all. So it's very unfair. But a lot of women have not understood that until they had the unfortunate situation of being divorced and a husband not retiring. So we need to explain that. I know that if you meet with a group of older people who are, which I have done, and among them, there are women who have worked outside the home and been paid for their work, they immediately understand and support the Equal Rights Amendment. It is the people who have not worked outside the home who do not understand it. And we have to make them understand it because it's their economic livelihood that's very much involved.
You told us earlier that you always wanted to run for political office. Is this, in a way, becoming president of NOW, is this fulfilling a dream for you?
Well, being head of an organization, being active in an organization is very different from being in the legislature. But I am very excited that I have been chosen to head NOW, and I'm really looking forward to being president. It's very wonderful for me.
Well, I want to thank you very much for speaking with us today.
Well, thank you. It's been a pleasure.
My guest has been Molly Yard, the new president of the National Organization for Women. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. On our next show, I'll speak with Ronnie Spector. She was the lead singer of the Ronettes, one of the best-known girl groups of the 60s. She now has a solo career and a new album, so I hope you can join us. Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY-FM in Philadelphia. This is NPR, National Public Radio. From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Coming up, novelist Tom Clancy talks about his new bestseller, Patriot Games. Clancy's novels of superpower conflict have earned him fans as diverse as President Reagan and the head of the Soviet Navy. Rock critic Ken Tucker reviews the new album from Kid Creole and the Coconuts, the musical alter ego of singer-songwriter and guitarist August Darnell. And film critic Stephen Schiff reviews the Disney classic Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs, which has been re-released in celebration of its 50th anniversary. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news from National Public Radio. This is Fresh Air. Our rock critic Ken Tucker has a review of the new album by Kid Creole and the Coconuts and a profile of the man behind the kid.
Kid Creole and the Coconuts is a pop music act dreamed up by a fellow named August Darnell. Unlike all the other somebody and the somethings that populate rock and roll, Kid Creole and the Coconuts is more of a concept than a reality. Darnell writes all the music, produces the records, and comes up with the elaborate stories that carry over from one album to the next. All the plot lines revolve around Darnell's alter ego, Kid Creole, a hopeless romantic who travels around the world looking for his one true love. Kid Creole's footloose quality gives Darnell an excuse to write songs that include pop musical styles from all over the world. On the new Coconuts album, the wonderfully titled I Too Have Seen the Woods, you can hear bits of funk, Latin, reggae, calypso, salsa, rock, jazz, and soul. Darnell himself calls it mulatto music. Here's a sample of August Darnell's Spicy Entertainment, a tune that manages to work in references to Hemingway, Shakespeare, and Charlotte Bronte while still providing a slinky rhythm. This is a song called So Far, So Good.
Yeah.
was Kid Creole and the Coconuts and a new song called So Far, So Good. August Darnell, who is Kid Creole, is a fascinating fellow. He's a former English teacher who hit pop music pay dirt in 1975 with the wittiest disco hit ever, Cherchez la Femme. It was recorded under the name Dr. Buzzard's original Savannah Band. Although his conversation in interviews is articulate and erudite, on stage, Darnell likes to pass himself off as a self-absorbed fop, as a combination of stud and sap. He's the only would-be rock star I know who would have the nerve to entitle an album Doppelganger and another called Off the Coast of Me. A year after that one, he released a song called I'm a Wonderful Thing, Baby. But Darnell's musical boasting isn't annoying. It's light and charming. Given his refusal to write simple lyrics and catchy choruses, it's no wonder that Kid Creole and the Coconuts haven't become rock stars. But August Darnell has his plans. About a year ago, he revealed that Joe Papp had asked him to come to New York's Public Theater and write a Kid Creolized version of any Gilbert and Sullivan operetta of his choosing. Papp's idea was that Darnell's intricate wordplay has a kinship with Gilbert and Sullivan's, and as far as the music goes, well, Darnell has been writing his own kind of pop operettas for years. So far, nothing has come of that proposal, but it suggests the range and ambition of this beguiling cult artist.
Ken Tucker writes about popular culture for the Philadelphia Inquirer. He reviewed I Too Have Seen the Woods, the new album by Kid Creole and the Coconuts. You're listening to Fresh Air. My guest is Tom Clancy. He's a small-town insurance agent who turned big-time author with the publication of his two best-selling thrillers, The Hunt for Red October and Red Storm Rising. His new bestseller, Patriot Games, continues the story of undercover CIA analyst Jack Ryan, who's the hero of The Hunt for Red October. When Ryan stops Irish terrorists from assassinating the Prince and Princess of Wales, he becomes the terrorist target. Clancy's large following includes many members of the military and the CIA who enjoy his detailed descriptions of high-tech weaponry and his realistic portrayal of intelligence operations. When I spoke with Tom Clancy, he told me that his readers like to give their opinions on the accuracy of his information.
Most often what happens to me is I'll have a submarine skipper, for example, come up to me and say, this is the book I gave my wife, and I told her, read this, this is all the stuff I can't tell you about. The comments I've had from people within the military community and also within the intelligence community have always been pretty complimentary. The CIA even did a review of The Hunt for Red October, which I couldn't read all of it because it was classified.
They do classified book reviews?
Evidently.
I guess it would be interesting to see your file.
I'd really be interested to see the one the Soviets have on me because I'm sure they don't believe I used to be an insurance agent.
Well, you've certainly written a lot of dialogue for your character, Jack Ryan. When he's asked if he is in the CIA, he's learned every way in the books to dodge that question.
Well, it makes you wonder what they do when they have to fill out an application for an American Express card. I guess they say they work for, you know, I work for the federal government and call this number, and they say, well, he works here, but he's classified. I've always wondered how they handle that, but I've never bothered asking. It's a little too mundane.
Your novels address war and terrorism, and I know that you yourself never served in the military, I think because of your...
My eyesight.
Bad
yes.
eyesight, yeah. Yeah. I guess I wonder in a way if there's an excitement for you in writing about conflict and weapons since you've never actually had to endure it.
Oh, that's a psychological question that should be left for a professional, I think. No, maybe it's just a realization on my part that if I wrote books about the exciting life of a country insurance agent, nobody, including myself, would buy them. If you look at Shakespearean dramas, how many English people got a chance to kill a king as Macbeth does, or to overturn a monarchy as Hamlet, Prince of Denmark, does? Does that mean they really wanted to, or they took great satisfaction in the thought of overthrowing a king? I don't know.
You worked as an insurance agent for years before becoming a writer. You earned your living selling insurance. When did you decide to actually try to write a novel?
I've wanted to write a novel since I was in high school. And really all I ever wanted to do was to see my name on the cover of a book. I thought that was as grand a thing as a person could do. So I wrote The Hunt for Red October when the right circumstances came together.
Which was what?
When you're your own, I became my own boss, and when you're your own boss, you make your own rules. So I just delegated to myself the time to write the book and submitted it to a publisher, and lo and behold, a couple of years later, I was a best-selling author, much to my surprise and occasionally to my horror. But
where does the horror come in?
One of my jokes about this is that success will ruin your life. I have to do so much running around now and speech making and book signing that occasionally I'm not as familiar with my children as I would like to be.
I think part of how your first novel ended up on the bestseller list was that President Reagan read it and said it was a very good yarn, and the press picked that up, and it really helped the book a lot. Did you know he was going to be reading it?
No, that came as a total surprise to me. It was out that comment in Time magazine came as much of a surprise to me as it did to anyone else. I didn't even know he had gotten the book.
Your new novel, Patriot Games, is about an ultra-radical terrorist group that breaks off from the IRA, and this group tries to assassinate the Prince and Princess of Wales. Why did you want to write about terrorism in your new book?
Well, the idea has been around for quite a while. I first started playing with it, I guess, around 1979. Also, the book is based on a real incident not too long ago. A person of dubious mental state attempted to assassinate Princess Anne. And, of course, it's well known that that Irish terrorists did, in fact, succeed in assassinating Lord Louis Mountbatten, who was also a member of the royal family.
What kind of research did you do?
Interestingly enough, I did about as much research for this as I did on the other two books combined. I spent 2 weeks in England. I met with some senior people in the Federal Bureau of Investigation, also some senior people in the Metropolitan Police, Scotland Yard in London, and also a few things with the Navy and the Coast Guard to see how they handle port security matters. So I spent more time out in the field research on this than I did with the other two.
Did you talk to anyone from the IRA?
No. I talked to a guy from the RUC who was shot in the back by the IRA, but that's as close as I got to the Irish terrorists.
You've made your CIA agent, Jack Ryan, a family man. As a matter of fact, in this book we learn early on that his wife is pregnant. Why have you made him a family man?
Well, you know, it's an that's a decision I made some time ago, actually, when I introduced Jack Ryan in The Hunt for Red October. The majority of people who appear in spy fiction, whether it's in books or movies, are 32 years old, single, boozers, womanizers, smokers who drive Ferraris or Aston Martins or something like that. Well, the fact of the matter is that most of the people who work in the security business, either in the FBI, CIA, or any other agency throughout the world, are pretty normal people. They have wives and children. They take their kids to Little League baseball and ballet practice, and they take them to movies, and they have birthday parties, and they have to cut the grass and fill out their tax returns just like the rest of us. So the fact of the matter is that most of these people are fairly ordinary. In the case of Patriot Games, the real issue we're trying to examine is, what if you are a fairly ordinary person? And within the body of the novel, Ryan is simply an instructor in history at the Naval Academy in Annapolis. And a person who has to lead a normal life, who can't run away, who can't hide, knows he's going to be a victim of terrorists. Well, how do you deal with that? And I thought it was time somebody wrote a book about the ordinary people who get in the way of these fellows.
Do you really think of him as ordinary?
He has a wife and a couple of kids. Yeah, that's ordinary. More so than the James Bond movie I was watching on HBO this morning, let's put it that way.
The acts of terrorism in your book and the terrorist groups are kind of removed from their political context. You don't really address motivation in it.
I do not care about their political motivation. I do not care about the motivation of the IRA any more than I care about the motivation of the Ku Klux Klan. They are criminals. They kill people.
Your new novel, the way I understand it, is going to be about SDI, the Strategic Defense Initiative, which is also known in the vernacular as Star Wars.
Yes.
Is it going to work in your novel?
Well, I have only 100 pages into the book yet, so I really don't know myself. Actually, we're examining SDI from a perspective which hasn't really gotten a lot of attention. People are talking about whether it'll shoot all the missiles down or not, and whether it will, in fact, start a new arms race, as though the arms race was not already underway, which, of course, it is. Now, I'm looking at SDI from the effect it's going to have on the geopolitical balance as of today. I mean, I'm not talking about a deployed system. I'm talking about the research and development that's going into the system now.
And what are you doing to research for that now?
Well, one main thing I'm looking for right now is to get information on Soviet SDI efforts. At the moment, I have I'm trying to get satellite imagery of Soviet SDI test facilities. And I've identified three or four sites within the Soviet Union where this research is being carried out with considerable vigor.
Is the research exciting for you in the way that it would be exciting to be an agent finding out that information, or to be a detective tracking down similar information?
One of the things I've always tried to do is to look at the world through the eyes of a child. I mean, my wife will tell you that I never really quite grew up. And I do that quite deliberately because I think when a kid looks at something, the kid sees more than an adult does. And that means the adult's missing something. So, yes, I do have I enjoy my research more than anything else I do, because I get to see things that most people never get a chance to see. And I get to see them from the inside. I get to talk to the people who do the real work. And that's an awful lot of fun.
Are any of your novels being made into movies?
Red October is supposedly going to be made into a movie, but that's the extent of my knowledge right there. I don't have that much in the way of communications with Hollywood. So I'll know as soon as they start rolling film. That's when they have to sign the check and send it out to me.
How would you describe yourself politically?
Reasonable.
Have you found that people from a wide political spectrum read your novels?
As a matter of fact, I autographed a copy of Red Storm Rising last year for the head of the Soviet Navy, so I guess that's a pretty wide political spectrum.
Okay, Tom Clancy, I want to thank you very much.
Hey, it's my pleasure.
Tom Clancy's new book is called Patriot Games. This is Fresh Air. You can hear full coverage of today's news on All Things Considered. Robert Siegel, who co-hosts the program, is joining us from Washington. Hi, Robert.
Hello, Terry.
What story are you following today?
We're following the Central American summit and the reaction there to President Reagan's plan announced yesterday for an end to the Nicaraguan civil war. We'll also have a report on the announcement that Pope John Paul II is going to be meeting with Jewish leaders following and probably about his meeting with the Austrian President Kurt Waldheim, which Jewish groups had opposed.
Any features to preview?
Yes, we'll have an interview with Melvin Connor, Dr. Melvin Connor, Harvard anthropologist turned medical student, now teaches anthropology at Emory University, and writes about his medical education.
Thanks, Robert. Those stories and more are coming up on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Fifty years ago, Walt Disney produced the first feature-length animation film, Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs. Many Disney animation classics followed, Pinocchio, Cinderella, Dumbo, Bambi. On its golden anniversary, Snow White is being re-released in more than 60 countries and in more than 10 languages. Our film critic Stephen Schiff has this review.
By all means, bring your kids. But if you don't have any, don't let that scare you away. Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs is an extraordinary movie by any standards. Oh, you might get a little tired of all those twittering bluebirds and chipmunks that seem so intent on helping our winsome heroine whistle while she works. And Snow White's bland cheeriness may make the behavior of the ill-tempered dwarf known as Grumpy seem all too justifiable. But 50 years after the first feature-length animation was unveiled, it's remarkable to see how powerful much of it remains. This, after all, is a teeming story of sexual awakening, of a teenager whose emerging adulthood threatens her aging but still beautiful stepmother, of a girl who prepares herself for the adult tasks of wife and motherhood by playing house with seven men who are not quite men, seven dwarfs who offer the challenges that men offer without letting sex raise its naughty head.
Why, your little Mim! How do you do?
How do you do what?
The dwarfs themselves are brilliantly drawn and differentiated characters, but they also embody individual traits that any prospective wife back in 1937 might have expected to find in her Prince Charming. Grumpiness, sleepiness, happiness, bashfulness, occasional dopiness, the peculiar combination of know-it-all and bumbler that you find in Doc, and, in the truly bizarre creature known as Sneezy, all those mysterious and out-of-control bodily functions that may take a girl by surprise on the wedding night and the weeks and months thereafter. Coping with the Seven Dwarfs teaches Snow White how to cope with Prince Charming, and has, in its very gentle way, prepared generations of young girls to welcome the strangeness of men. Not that this movie is a glorified self-help book. For one thing, it's a musical with gorgeous songs, including Someday My Prince Will Come, which has become a bebop standard, Whistle While You Work, and this odd hymn to the glories of all-American labor.
Hi-ho, 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 it's home to work we go. Hi-ho, hi-ho.
It's also a work of marvelous imagination. You may not remember how truly wondrous those scenes are in which a baleful magic mirror speaks to a wicked ruler who begs it to flatter her, or a dark forest comes alive with menace, or a beautiful queen turns herself into a hag bearing an apple as tempting as the one the serpent offered Eve, an apple that with one bite will confer the dreadful sleeping death. Too scary for kids? The child psychologist Bruno Bettelheim has argued that fairy tales like Snow White help children learn to cope with and even conquer an intimidating world. And for grown-ups, a picture as imaginative and full of life as this one can make you walk out of the theater as smitten with movies as any child.
Stephen Schiff is critic at large for Vanity Fair.
Just whistle while you work, and cheerfully together we can tidy up the place. So I'm a merry tune. It won't take long when there's a song to help you set the pace. And as you sweep the room, imagine that the broom is someone that you love, and soon you'll find you're dancing to the tune.
Here's what's coming up on our next program. Next time, I'll speak with performance artist Eric Bogosian. He's made a career of spurning convention, but with the success of his off-Broadway play Talk Radio, Hollywood's calling, and Bogosian says he's interested. Also, folk musician Michael Cooney will be back to play a few old love songs, and critic at large Laurie Stone will review the new play Psycho Beach Party. So I hope you can join us. And we'd like to welcome a station new to Fresh Air, KRCC, in Colorado Springs, Colorado. We thank everyone who helps make Fresh Air possible.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced.
Our senior producer is Danny Miller. Our producers are Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, and Naomi Person. Ed Doherty is the production assistant. Additional assistance from Lisa Bruton. Our engineer is Ron Barron. Chris Spurgeon directs the show. I'm Terry Gross. Thanks for listening. This is NPR, National Public Radio.